Good morning, everyone. Nice to have you here. First case of the day. Wow, numbers. 10-21-40, 10-21-81, 10-21-82. United States versus Joshua, Karras, and Allen. Good morning.
This is a joint appeal by all three defendant appellants who were convicted in the U.S. District Court, Judge Simon, of two counts of mail fraud alleged in an indictment. During the course of the trial, the defense, all the defendants, relied upon and, in fact, at the conclusion of all the evidence, submitted the Seventh Circuit pattern instruction pertaining to good faith. We've recited in the brief the various items of evidence pertaining to that issue that were presented. At the conclusion of all of the evidence in the case, near the conclusion of the final instruction conference before Judge Simon, the government tendered what became final instruction 22A at page 85 of the appendix, for the first time asserting the so-called defense of advice of counsel. This was objected to. It was objected to on the basis that that was not a defense that was being relied upon by any of the defendant appellants. And after the...
But doesn't the instruction that the court gave put advice of counsel exactly in this context that you're arguing? You may consider the advice given by counsel to a defendant in deciding whether defendant possessed the requisite intent. And so advice of counsel is just an element you may consider, but it's relevant to intent only under certain circumstances.
Correct. And the one of the problems with the instruction is it goes on to say if you find, and it lists out a series of categories. The problem is there is no allocation in either this instruction or all of the instructions taken together allocating either the burden of persuasion or defining what standard of proof is applicable to a jury's finding of those elements, if you will, of advice of counsel.
So why does every instruction have to repeat the general instruction that the court gives stating that the government has the burden of proof?
Because in this circumstance, I believe that, and looking at the case law that we have cited in Van Allen, and I believe as well in Al-Shaheen, that in fact the burden of establishing the constitutional elements of that have previously been said by this court to fall upon the defendant. However, I have found no case where the appropriate standard of proof is articulated. And in these instructions, all of these instructions as a whole, we are left with the proposition on, again, a defense that was not urged by the defendants.
Well, in the instruction immediately preceding this,
yes,
it concludes with a reminder to the jury that the burden is on the government to prove the intent to defraud beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yes.
And you read the instructions as a whole.
We do. And the problem is, with 22A coming right afterward, it states you have to make you may consider advice of counsel if you find, and then it lists these elements. And the problem is, there is no standard of proof allocated to that finding. The only standard of proof articulated in the instructions as a whole was proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
On the government in each instance.
That is exactly
and
what
in
was...
In fact, there's an instruction that says the defendant doesn't have to prove anything or something to that.
That's correct. There is contained in those instructions. So
you read them as a whole, not... I'm concerned that you're just pulling this out of out of a much larger context.
Well, I think we pull it out of a context that's larger than the testimony of the attorney, which was the triggering event for the government's tender of this instruction. There was other evidence, and I think other evidence of some significance, regarding the issue of good faith, which, of course, is the antithesis to an intent to defraud.
I'm going to interrupt because I was very interested in that, because you seem to treat good faith and advice of counsel as two different defenses. But I read your defense to be that the defendants acted in good faith because they relied on the advice of counsel. And if that is the case, and I see you nodding, but I'm not sure if you're nodding in agreement.
Nervous tick.
Can't move your head. What is wrong with telling a jury how they can use that testimony? Because I was wondering what other relevance did Mr. Work's testimony have?
Reading all of the cases I found on this issue in the Seventh Circuit, first of all, it appears that where a defendant is asking for advice of counsel, and that's one of the reasons we allude to this concept of entrapment by estoppel, two cases out of the Second Circuit, that advice of counsel appears to be appropriate where you're dealing with a general intent offense under circumstances where you're saying, hey, a lawyer told me, and after I made all the disclosure and did everything the lawyer told me to do, the lawyer told me that this was okay to do. In a specific intent offense, I believe that evidence of good faith is evidence of good faith, whether it's the lawyer, whether it's the financial advisor, as was the case in this trial, whether it's evidence that everything the defendant appellants did in terms of receiving money was not only published and voted upon by the fiscal body, it was filed with the appropriate agencies of state and local government, and it was published in the newspaper, and the other incidents and circumstances we refer to. So that in those circumstances involving specific intent, we believe that what Mr. Work had to testify to was and should have been simply received as probative, as it was during his testimony, as probative of good faith.
But
because
though,
this was specific.
You're essentially saying, though, that there should never be an instruction that guides the jury about how to evaluate advice of counsel. Mr. Work is testifying about what he advised them, and it has been the law that advice of counsel alone, counsel can't instruct you how to violate the law. I mean, there are criteria for advice of counsel, and that's all this instruction reviews.
In response to the earlier question of trying to explain that circumstance with opinions in this circuit that describe advice of counsel as not being a defense and not being a standalone defense.
And I'm not describing it as a defense either, but is it pertinent to the intent issue all the time, in your view, or is it only pertinent some of the time?
It's only pertinent some of the time.
Okay, so why can't the judge instruct the jury about which instances are permissible?
Because in a case involving specific intent, where the law of the circuit is clear, in fact, reduced to a pattern instruction, that good faith, proof of good faith, is probative of the absence of the specific intent, that any source of information, if believed by the jury, to have been given and to have some credibility to it, be it an attorney's statements relied upon by defendants, should not elevate it to additional criteria in a specific intent offense as contrasted with lay experts, as was the case in the prosecution in the district court here.
But what I'm looking at are the criteria in this paragraph that you're objecting to. What it's trying to get at, I think, is the case of the person who goes to the lawyer and gives a dishonest account to the lawyer of what the person is doing, and the lawyer says in response to this misleading account, that sounds fine with me, you can go ahead and do this, and yet that kind of advice of counsel, it seems to me, couldn't possibly be relevant to good faith. That's actually fully consistent with intent to defraud, if you will.
In circumstances where that would be the evidence, there is no prohibition against the government, after receiving what the attorney statement advice relied upon by the defense might be, for the government, by way of cross-examination or other form of rebuttal to that testimony, point out the insufficiency of either the disclosure or the conduct following the giving of the advice. To couch this in terms of saying, for you to consider the testimony of the attorney, you have to, if we take the instructions as a whole, you have to find the government proved beyond a reasonable doubt that all of these things happened.
But wait, in order to use that defense with Mr. Work's testimony, the defendants were obliged to demonstrate that they fully informed the attorney of the circumstances and then strictly followed the advice.
If we sought reliance on that defense, we did not. We presented it as good faith. And when we read, there was an objection relatively early in Mr. Work's testimony, reflected in the record, and a hearsay and, I believe, a relevance objection by the trial attorney for the government.
Look, advice of counsel is not a standalone defense.
Correct.
It has to be used, you know, as part of his good faith defense. And you're parsing the two out, it seems to me.
Yes, I am. And I'm suggesting that where reliance, the best read I can give is that where you ask for advice of counsel, it's appropriate if you are in a general intent offense and yet you seek to present to the jury, I didn't know this was wrong. And there's some discussion in the Erfurt decision by Judge Posner between malum and se malum prohibita. And I don't want to unduly intrude on my colleague's rebuttal time here. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Okay, colleague, come on up. Oh, I'm sorry. He's going to do the rebuttal.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I thought you were going to. Okay. Yeah. Boy, your time went fast. Okay, good morning, Mr. Holler.
Good morning, Judge Redmer. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I guess since the counsel spent all of his time on the advice of counsel defense, I would like to start there as well. Your Honor, we believe that the instructions as a whole in this case did not mislead the jury. We believe that instruction 22A was an accurate statement of the law. We don't believe that anything in that instruction would have led the jury to believe they had to find that fact beyond a reasonable doubt in favor of the defendant in order to make those findings. Previous instructions, both instruction 10 and instruction 22, repeated that the government had to prove all of the elements of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. And the instructions also made clear that the defendant had no burden to disprove his good faith, that good faith is evidence of a lack of intent to defraud. And similarly, if the defendants had in this case, in good faith, relied on counsel, that too would have been evidence of a lack to defraud. The defendants.
Let me ask you this. So I'm looking at the language of, it's fundamentally a pattern instruction. It doesn't say you may consider the advice given by counsel if the government proves that the defendant in good faith sought the advice. You know, it's just sort of an open-ended if you find. And I wonder where subjectivity, if at all, enters into this. Suppose the defendant tells the lawyer everything the defendant thinks is material, but omits something that actually some objective observer would realize was material. In other words, the defendant just makes a mistake. How does that fit in with this instruction?
Well, Your Honor, I think that if it's a full and accurate report of all the material facts which the defendant knew and the defendant, in good faith, failed to recognize that a certain fact was material, I think the jury would read this instruction and say that's still consistent with good faith. That really never came
so
up in this case.
New to be material somehow is also
new to be, I think so. Material facts which the defendant knew, I sort of read as new to be material. I mean, we're parsing the instruction a little more carefully than was done in the defendant's objection at trial, so I don't know that they've really preserved. They objected to the instruction as a whole. I'm not disputing that. And they also proposed a line at the end saying the government has to disprove these factors beyond a reasonable doubt, which I also think was incorrect, and they haven't really raised that that fact here as well. So I think.
So why do you think that was incorrect?
That in order to establish there was a scheme to defraud, the government had to disprove all of these elements beyond a reasonable doubt. I don't think we had to disprove all of the elements of this instruction beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury could have, for example, believed that Dozier Allen sought the advice in good faith, but met that element, but then didn't follow the advice because when Fred Work said, you know, you have to do work to get this money, they didn't. So we don't have to disprove every element. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that their instruction was an accurate statement of law, and therefore it was okay to reject that. And the question, again, is just whether the instructions as a whole were accurate. This language comes from, I believe, Van Allen itself. I think it's a direct quote, and it's similar to pattern instructions that have been given. Instructions can always be written better, especially when they're written, we didn't know what Fred Work was going to testify to until he did, and then had to kind of come up with this instruction overnight.
Mr. Holler, I'm going to move you on, if you don't mind, to the mailing, because you seem to have been caught off guard with proving the mailing when Lewis testified that sometimes the checks were picked up. I know that she testified that Exhibit 6 was mailed.
She did.
But had she not already testified that she wasn't the person who did the mailing? I mean, in other words, it seemed that she testified to something that she had no personal knowledge of.
I don't think she testified to something she had no personal knowledge of. There was testimony, Your Honor, in the record that her cubicle or her area was directly across the aisle from Marion Smith, the woman who actually did the mailing. She testified she's essentially in charge of the accounting department. She's very familiar with the mailings and the procedures that go on at WDS. And that's all that you have to have. You don't have to have the person who actually did the mailing who performed it, as long as they know the procedures and are familiar with the procedures.
Yeah, but, you know, your whole case seems to me to be riding on the assumption that an office wouldn't unnecessarily waste 48 cents worth of postage.
I don't think that's
but,
all.
Wait a minute.
Okay, that's fine.
My turn.
I apologize.
But, you know, waste is very common in offices other than R3. But, and let's be honest, inertia is, you know, very common, too. Why isn't it equally likely that the metered envelope sat around until someone came to get it without testimony about the regular practice for a pickup? All the jury had was speculation.
I don't believe
it. I'm really worried about this.
I understand that, Your Honor, and there is no doubt that the mailing in this case was thin. There's no doubt that we don't get an A for the mailing here. I agree with that. But I believe that there is no, whatever the testimony would have been about the practices for pickup, a juror could reasonably infer that the procedures for pickup would not involve metering the envelope, that therefore something would have had to be a change or a break in the procedure. I think that's an assumption.
Is there any evidence, you know, telling us how often checks were picked up versus how often they were mailed?
Your Honor, the only evidence in the record is that they were usually mailed. That is the only testimony in the record. I can see that is thin testimony, and I can't do anything about that. But when one combines the fact that they are – I understand, Your Honor, but when one concedes that they are – this is a far cry from Brooks and Swinson, where there's just no way to know, okay, where somebody said, I have no way of knowing whether this check was picked up or whether this check was mailed in Brooks or in Swinson, where there's very, very concrete, specific evidence that on the specific mailing at issue, the check was not mailed. Here we have evidence that a meter mark was affixed to the postage, which is what is done. The envelope is stuffed. The thing is metered, and then it's taken to the post office. We also then have a delay in the dates. We have a delay, not something that would be consistent with pickup. Because
I thought that was maybe true for one of your letters,
right, but not
the week letter. But then there's the other letter. It's just the next day, the received stamp, which could, in my view, just as easily have been because the envelope sat there in somebody's desk, and the next morning they hit received. I don't know what time of day.
It was received at 1:51 p.m. It wasn't received in the morning. So, again, you'd have to – I mean
– do you get overnight delivery often? I mean, honestly, if it was – I guess the post meter said one day and the receipt is the very next day.
That's true. It is received the very next. Do you get overnight delivery? I mean, I've gotten overnight delivery in Chicago, Your Honor. I don't know. I mean, again, this is a the jurors are from the area. They're
this
from the community. but that's the entire point, Your Honor, I'm trying to make. I mean, the jurors are from the area. They know whether it's consistent. They can sit there in the jury room and say, is it consistent with my experiences at jurors who live in Gary that we sometimes get mail-in deliveries
about delivery rate in that part of the city, or you had nothing about that?
No. The only evidence we presented was from the postal inspector, and that was presented to refute the defendant's claim that the absence of meter marks meant something, that the absence of cancellation meant anything.
Well, of course, he said that, you know, there's no way to tell from looking at the envelopes whether they went through the mail.
That is true. And so, therefore, we are relying on the presence of a meter, which, I mean, there was evidence, again, that you could rely on in this case. There was evidence that the workers, that Angela Lewis, that the other workers who testified from WDS were conscientious, that they brought evidence of what they felt was somewhat wasteful spending of this grant money itself to their bosses. They're the people on the line who are running them through the postage meter. And so the question is just, the normal course of things for postal delivery would be to meter the stamp, to pay the 48 cents, and then to deliver it, and then have it be delivered not on that date, but on some date later. The evidence was not that they used, and again, my understanding from the record, if you look back at the actual testimony of Angela Lewis, is her testimony essentially was that not that an overnight delivery service was used. They wouldn't have used a local courier, but that someone essentially going back and forth between the two offices would have picked it up.
Only about 3 blocks apart.
Right. So again, I don't think that it would have been therefore consistent if somebody's picking it up with, we're here on our normal duty, we're going back to work 3 blocks away and dropping it there. There was testimony that rarely occurred. James McShane testified he never saw anyone from Calumet Township in their offices, and Angela Lewis was the only who was the one who testified this thing is mailed, was the only person who testified who McShane testified ever went to the township offices. It isn't as if these two offices regularly interact.
Sometimes she testified that sometimes these checks were mailed, and as I recall, sometimes they were picked up by someone from the trustee's office.
I believe that was her testimony. Usually, the only correction, my recollection of the quote, if I'm incorrect, I apologize, is usually they're mailed and sometimes they're picked up. That was the testimony. So I think there's a presumption towards usual anyway. There's a meter mark that is consistent with that. There is stamping of a different date between the meter mark and the date it was received. There's testimony from McShane that says, really, I never saw anyone from Calumet Township in our offices. And there's therefore the usuality of practice. All of that then means that's enough for us to get to the jury. And if the jury wanted to say some of the questions that you guys are asking of, I don't know, maybe this thing seems like it's, you know, this company seems like they waste postage and they wouldn't care about this. Or, you know, this doesn't seem consistent with my experiences with Gary mail delivery. Then, you know, we made this case harder than we should have. And the jury would have been well within its rights to acquit. This wouldn't be by any means a harmless error case or anything like that. If I stood up here and said that, you would rightly shoot me down. But under these circumstances, we had barely enough to get to the jury, and therefore we had more than sufficient evidence of everything else, including the scheme to defraud, the intent to defraud, and the mailing and furtherance of the fraud. So we believe that that's been proved. I guess just to briefly discuss the Skilling matter, Your Honor, this is different from the Black case because of the existence of the special verdict forms. The jury did find that there was a money or property scheme to defraud, and all of that evidence would have come in for the reasons we've explained as well. So, therefore, there was an error. There is an error in light of Skilling, but it's not a plain error. It doesn't justify reversal of these convictions because they're still convicted on that point. I know you turned me away from the advice of counsel issue, but if anybody has any other questions they want to raise on that issue, I would be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I feel we fully explained that in our brief, and we would ask that the convictions be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Going with the last first, or the mail fraud question first, I would point out that the court is accurate in grasping that, in fact, there was no evidence, no direct evidence of mailing.
Now, there's not usually direct evidence that a particular letter has been mailed, especially if there's a postal meter. It's more like normal business practice.
Correct. And it can be as long as there is no evidence of deviation. In this case, and that's basically what all the cases that talk about using the general practice of mailing as proof of mailing and sufficient circumstantial evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt mailing is as long as there is no evidence of deviation. But
so
Angela
what was
Lewis.
The evidence in the record about the practices in the trustee's office for stamping items received? Did
zero.
That always happen immediately, or did that happen when people?
There was zero evidence about any practices in the trustee's office regarding receiving, handling, or stamping.
So couldn't the jury, in the absence of evidence, rationally assume that it's stamped received when it is received? In other words, a few days later? Almost a week later in the case of one letter, a day later in the case of the other.
There are assumptions you could make, but again,
or would it be a rational inference for the jury without any evidence to point in the other direction?
Well, but it doesn't carry the proof beyond a reason, exclude reasonable doubt as to when somebody put received on the envelope. The employee could have been on vacation. That's why it was 4 days late. For instance, the one that the government argues that, well, it was over the Thanksgiving holiday, I believe he said, and therefore there would be an anticipation by everybody that the mail would take longer. Well, the same argument can be made that the person doing the stamping didn't come to work that day because of the fact that they were on Thanksgiving vacation, just like the postal employees. So there are reasonable inferences going both ways, and what the law says is that in that situation, it is not sufficient evidence produced by the government to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt or prove mailing beyond a reasonable doubt. And in
so
this case,
48 cents is really just too trivial to worry about, that one shouldn't draw the inference that you would only run envelopes through the post meter that were then immediately taken to the post office.
If there had been evidence that Marion Smith, who did not testify, but who was testified, did all the mailing, if she had come and said, I knew beforehand, before I ran this through the meter, whether or not it was going to go through the mail or whether or not it was going to be picked up, then that would be extremely probative. There was no such evidence. She did not testify. We don't know when the determination was made inside WDS's office as to this is going to be picked up or this is not going to be picked up. There is no evidence. So all we have is Angela Lewis saying that usually it was mail, sometimes it was picked up.
This is presumably all of WDS's outgoing mail, not just mail going to the trustee's office.
That question was not asked. I believe it would be a reasonable assumption that some mail is mailed and some's not.
Well, some mail is going to some other Indiana government office, and some mail is paying bills, and some mail is doing whatever else. You know,
correct.
Else,
yes. And there's just no evidence about it, but you know, there could be some assumption. Shifting quickly to the advice of counsel, I want to point out that it's our position, I represent Ms. Karras, that the advice of counsel defense shouldn't even been, or a specter of it should not have been raised. We have Ms. Karras sitting in an audience. Mr. Allen is not her attorney. Hearing a lawyer saying what's going on is okay. This is what Mr. Work testified to. At a public meeting, when queried by one of the directors, the president of the board, as to whether or not this payment to the employees and Mr. Allen were okay, Mr. Work said, yes, they are. Now, on the issue of good faith, Ms. Karras, sitting in the audience, hearing the lawyer of 20-plus years of the township saying that this conduct is okay.
This conduct of putting all the money into their pockets is okay?
Paying the money. That's what he testified to. That under the circumstances, and there was a resolution that was passed. There's a long litany of facts that I don't have an opportunity to go into. But it still goes to the question of good faith. And whether it was Fred Work or James Bennett or anybody else, as long as Ms. Karras heard something that would have given her the opinion and the belief that because Mr. Work, an attorney for 20-some years, who we're always taught, listen to your lawyer, said something is okay, why then that the jury couldn't consider that? The jury, you cannot consider that unless, as I understand the government proved beyond a reason without that all these factors. Well, there's no way that Ann Karras could have proved any of those factors. And, in fact, she and Ms. Joshua, for sure, were robbed of the potential benefit of Attorney Work's testimony and of Attorney Work's statement. Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel. The case is going to be taken under advisement.